Well, obviously, big day. A lot of us looking forward to the game, the Super Bowl this afternoon, making plans and a chance to watch that as we're rooting for our hometown team to win it for a second year in a row. But maybe I'm not the only one in the room. I'm finding that, honestly, I think there's part of me that's still recovering from the game 2 weeks ago and that incredible comeback win over the Packers in that NFC Championship game, a comeback that many described with the word miraculous. What's been interesting, I admit, I'm a bit of a geek on this and been reading a lot of things online. I can't tell you how many times I've watched some of the summary videos and just relived the moment over the last weeks and reading the interviews with different players and fans as well. But one of the things that stood out to me, and maybe it did to you as well, with the recap, and particularly in those immediate moments after the game, over and over again, you heard lots of talk, particularly from players afterward, about faith and about belief. We just kept fighting, said safety Cam Chancellor. We kept telling each other to believe. Our wide receiver Doug Baldwin ranted at reporters, at 16-0 at the half, how many of you counted us out? How many of y'all doubted us? It is indicative of our season. Y'all didn't want to believe in us. It's okay. We don't need you to believe. We're going to believe in ourselves. And as for our ever-positive quarterback, Russell Wilson, he was mic'd up during the game. And as he paced the sidelines talking to teammates, and sometimes just kind of talking to himself, here's what Wilson was saying. We've only got 4 minutes left. Let's go. Stay in it. Man, I want it. Man, I want it. I hate losing, he said. Another point, he's like, believe in me, love of God, he's pointing to the sky, it's all about you. And elsewhere, you just got to keep believing, man, no doubt in my mind, bro. That word believe, as you can see on the screen, has now gotten linked to the Seahawks like never before after that game. You can get it on a t-shirt, a pendant, a coffee mug, a cell phone cover, you name it. But all of this has got me wondering. You see, the object of our believing isn't always clear. Who or what exactly are we to believe in? Is it just believe in yourself? Believe in your teammates? You know, some after the game, you know, the post-game interviews were trying to say thanks to God for what they understood. Is that it? Are we to believe in God because of what the result of the game was? You know, at some point we can have a lively discussion, perhaps another day, about the role of faith in football or other sports. What do we make of athletes who give a shout-out to the Lord after a touchdown or a victory? We'll save that conversation for another day, but for now, just know this. If God is not a Seahawks fan, then why is the sky blue and the grass green? Just leave it there. So in the meantime, let's just recognize that these exhortations to believe, as sometimes as opaque and ambiguous as they are really nothing new. In fact, I want this to lead us right back to the Gospel of Luke that we've been doing this survey of these last couple weeks. Because today, we're going to see three calls to faith in response to Jesus. We're going to take three explorations into the lives of people who believe and some who don't. But I also want us to hear three invitations to us to believe, to put our faith in Jesus. So some of you are already doing. Would you pull out a Bible or maybe pulling up on your phone or a tablet if you bring that with you? Turn to Luke chapter 7. It'll be helpful to have the text in front of you because we're not going to go through it beginning to end. In fact, in my study of it this week, what I came to realize was this chapter begins and ends with stories of men in positions of power and prestige. But in between are two stories of two women in great need whom Jesus shows great compassion. But at the center of this chapter is a three-part confrontation about Jesus' true identity and purpose. And that's where I want to begin, is right in the middle. Now, if you've been following along with us in our survey of Luke, you'll recall that a major character in the first chapters of the gospel was John the Baptist. In chapter 3, in the middle of the story about John baptizing Jesus, Luke gives us a little bit of an aside and tells us that Herod Antipas, the ruler over the province of Galilee, locked John up in prison. And so since then, as we've worked our way through the story, John has been out of sight as Jesus has been the focus of each subsequent scene. But now, from his offstage position, John sends some disciples to come and to question Jesus. Verse 20. When the men came to Jesus, they said, "John the Baptist sent us to you to ask, 'Are you the one who has come, or should we expect someone else?'" And so here we get the first of three prompts that call us to faith in the identity of Jesus, is the first prompt, the identity of Jesus. You see, John knows Jesus. I mean, they're likely cousins, perhaps born just about 6 months apart. John knows his own role was to prepare the way for the Messiah who was supposed to proclaim freedom for prisoners and release of the oppressed. And so now here he is sitting as a prisoner in jail, wondering what's going on. He knows time is running short. He's got questions about Jesus' identity as the Messiah and Son of God. "Are you really the one?" he asks. And Jesus responds to the identity question, not with words necessarily, but with actions. Verse 21. "At that very time, Jesus cured many who had diseases, sicknesses, and evil spirits, and gave sight to many who were blind. So he replied to the messengers, 'Go back and report to John what you've seen and heard. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is proclaimed to the poor. Blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me,' Jesus says." See, Jesus is smart. With all the people listening in, Jesus knows that he can't just come out and say, "Yep, I'm the Messiah. Here's my ID card. Messiah, I'm him." In fact, in a few chapters, we're going to hear that Herod turns his sights to Jesus and actually wants to kill him. So instead here, Jesus points to the work he is doing, healing diseases, casting out demons, proclaiming the gospel, all works of the Messiah, and essentially he says, "Draw your own conclusions." But please don't miss this. John is doubting. John was filled with the Holy Spirit from birth. He came in the power of Elijah, the great prophet. He fulfilled the prophecies by preparing the way for the Messiah, and yet he wrestles with the question, "Who is Jesus?" Honestly, that gives me a lot of hope that my own questions and uncertainties, that my struggles to live out my faith and trust in Jesus in every area of my life is really not that unusual. Jesus shows no signs of being frustrated or disappointed with John. I think likewise, Jesus is patient with you and with me as well. But see, this is a call to faith. The identity of Jesus actually calls for honest faith that doubts sincerely. Like John, we should go to Jesus with our doubts when they arise, with our questions, "Are you really who you say you are?" In fact, just a little over a week ago, I was having coffee with a friend who'd come down from Bellingham. This friend of mine has, the last year or so, have been really challenging in lots of different ways, particularly with his involvement with his church. Some things have happened that were really, personally for him, a big struggle. There was some conflict that he ended up involved with. In some ways, it's really kind of hit his faith hard and made him ask some tough questions. And as we sat there over coffee together, talking and sharing, you know, he mentioned that while this has kind of rocked his faith in some ways, called him, you know, maybe kind of questioning the church and what the church is about, you know, he said, "I'm still comfortable, you know, with God the Father. I don't really have a problem with God the Spirit. But I'm just struggling with approaching God the Son." And so as I looked at him across the table, I just asked, "Well, have you talked to Jesus about that?" And at first he kind of just snickered, but then it hit him. He said, "No." I said, "You might want to, because I think Jesus can handle our questions and our doubts just fine. And when we take our questions to Jesus, he points to what he has done as he patiently reveals his identity to us." Folks, doubt is not the opposite of belief. Doubt, when engaged sincerely and honestly, can lead to a much richer faith in the living Christ. The opposite of belief is not doubt, it is unbelief. And we see that too in this chapter. In fact, when Jesus addressed John, the disciples of John the Baptist, he said in verse 23, "Blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me." In other words, you are among the fortunate and the favored. If I do not cause you to be offended, or literally the word there transliterated is to be scandalized. While the identity of Jesus leads some to have an honest faith that can incorporate sincere doubt, it leads others to take offense and even fall into sin. See, John the Baptist is not the only one asking questions about Jesus' identity and experiencing doubt in this chapter. There are Pharisees, there are teachers of the law, there are those Jesus calls just the people of this generation who are too. See, after John's disciples leave there in the middle of the chapter, Jesus explains John's role to the crowds who are gathered. And then in verse 31, we read this. Jesus went on to say, "To what then can I compare the people of this generation? What are they like? Well, they're like children sitting in the marketplace and calling out to each other, 'We played the pipe for you and you did not dance. We sang a dirge and you did not cry.'" See, for John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine, and you say he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and you say, "Here is a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners." But wisdom is proved ripe by all her children. What Jesus is doing is comparing his generation to children for whom nothing makes them happy. I think we've all had encounters with kids like this, haven't we? Kids who just don't seem to be pleased with anything, whether it's our own children or a niece or a nephew or maybe a grandchildren that you might be watching. They just seem to be unsatisfied. You know, my son comes to me and says, "Dad, I'm bored." "Hey, would you want to play a game together?"
"No."
"Yeah. Want to read some stories?"
"No."
"Want to go ride your bike?"
"No."
"You're fine. Just go clean your room." You know, I mean, we just, that sense of just nothing makes them happy. Jesus says the people of this generation are to be likened to that situation where one group of young children is apparently complaining about the behavior of others. We get this picture, the two groups with one extending an invitation to come, play, dance, and sing, and the other is going,
"No."
Of John, they said, "He has a demon." Of Jesus, they had little better to say, "He is a lush." The Pharisees and the experts in the law reject them both. And Jesus comes with songs of celebration, the joy of new beginnings and new relationships, but they won't dance. John comes with a song of mourning. The death bell rings for our old sinful way. Pride is crucified and the flesh is slain, but they won't cry. Whoever God sent, they wanted somebody else. Whatever God's message, they wanted something else. The unwise face the question of Jesus and his identity, and they rush to judgment based on their own expectations and desires. But the wise pause and explore the evidence and wrestle sincerely with their doubts, with an openness to be surprised. It has been rightly said that Christ distinguished between doubt and unbelief. Doubt says, "I can't believe, at least not yet." Unbelief says, "I won't believe." Doubt is honest. Unbelief is obstinate. So first, the identity of Jesus calls for honest faith that doubts sincerely. But second, we also see in this chapter the compassion of Jesus. Bracketing that center of the chapter and Jesus' confrontation with those questioning his identity, Jesus interacts with two women who are both in great need. The first is in an encounter with a widow whose son has recently died. Verse 12, follow along as I'll read aloud. Verse 12. As Jesus approached the town gate, a dead person was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, which, by the way, means she now, in that first century culture without Social Security or Medicare or a pension plan or a 401k to draw on, she has no one to work and to provide for her needs as a woman in that culture. And a large crowd came from the town that was with her. When the Lord saw her, his heart went out to her, and he said, "Don't cry." Then he went up and touched the bier they were carrying him on, and the bearer stood still. He said, "Young man, I say to you, get up." The dead man sat up and began to talk, and Jesus gave him back to his mother. So two processions collide, the funeral procession emerging from the village, and Jesus with his disciples entering the village. And Jesus doesn't look past the woman, and continue on his way, but sees her need, and his heart went out to this woman. He felt great affection and compassion for her. And in what won't be the last occurrence of this, we see here that Jesus has a habit of breaking up funerals. Jesus is touching that burial plank would have or should have left him ceremonially unclean. But again, as with the leper healed in chapter 5, cleanness and healing go out from Jesus and infect the dead young man, not the other way around. Now, how would you have reacted if you were among the mourners in that procession heading out to the gravesite? You know, 2 weeks ago, 60,000 plus people at CenturyLink Stadium and millions more watching at home thought there was a certain football team that had been left for dead. There was profound grief that turned to jubilant celebration in about 10 minutes. I mean, we all remember what that was like, that shift from grief to just celebration. Can you imagine this crowd? I mean, winning a football game in that fashion was amazing. But resuscitating a dead man on the way to his grave, that is a true miracle. So what are they experiencing? Shock? Disbelief? Delight? I mean, you can see their eyes darting back and forth between the young man who is now alive, but with that dazed, "Where am I?" look on his face, and Jesus, who must have had an enormous smile and look of delight on his face. Well, a bit later, Jesus has another encounter with another woman in great need and again shows his compassion. Verse 36, when one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him, he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. A woman in that town who lived a sinful life learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house. So she came there with an alabaster jar of perfume. As she stood behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. You see, this scene is a dinner party here, hosted by a Pharisee named Simon. Jesus is often in conflict with them, but he's not opposed to Pharisees in general, nor to Simon in particular. He accepts the invitation to dinner. And likewise, Simon appears to not be openly hostile to Jesus, invites Jesus to dinner, shares table fellowship with him. But in verse 37, we see that there's another figure in this scene, an immoral intruder. She is not named. She is just simply described as a woman who is in the city, a sinner. But the word picture for sinner is one of not hitting, of missing. This is a woman whose life has missed the mark. She has strayed. She is way off target. This woman would not have entered the house unnoticed. She would have been seen and snubbed by the invited guests and visitors alike. But notice that Jesus does not do anything to call attention to her or embarrass her. He doesn't shame her. He receives her as she is. Verse 44. Then he turned toward the woman and said, "Simon, do you see this woman? I came into your house, into your house, and you did not give me any water for my feet. But she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not greet me and give me a kiss. But this woman, from the time I entered, has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, as her great love has shown. But whoever has been forgiven little loves little." And then Jesus said to her, "Your sins are forgiven." Jesus is compassionate. And the compassion of Jesus calls for bold faith that loves lavishly. The woman's faith is bold. To come before Jesus in this way is a great risk. She demonstrates the ability to overcome barriers, such as the popular perceptions about her. And a woman to even contemplate publicly drawing near to Jesus like this was a risk, for women did not do that in public in that culture. And the fact that she is known for being sinful only heightens the risk and the need for boldness, since a religious figure like Jesus could simply reject her. And yet, in gratitude and humility, she is drawn to Jesus to lavish love upon him. And the woman's love for Jesus is truly lavish, as is seen in the sacrifice of the costly perfume used to anoint Jesus' feet. She comes filled with thanksgiving as she sees that they haven't extended to Jesus even common courtesy. She cannot greet him with a kiss, but she can kiss his feet. She didn't come prepared with a towel, but she can wash his feet with her hair, with her tears, and dry them with her hair. She would not presume to put oil on his head, as the host should have done, but she can use her perfume to anoint his feet. She offers her love and tries to compensate for the insult or lack of love that Jesus is being shown by others. She gives to Jesus a public gesture of great devotion. This same Jesus has shown you and me great compassion too, through the forgiveness of our sins as well. May we too respond with a bold faith that loves as lavishly. And then third and finally, Luke takes us through not only stories reflecting Jesus' identity and his compassion, but we also see in this chapter the authority of Jesus once more. Luke is here revisiting a topic in two encounters with two men who come with their own power and authority. First, we've already been introduced to Simon the Pharisee, who just can't come to terms with who Jesus is. Verse 39, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him, what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner. Simon thinks he's one up on Jesus, thinks he knows something that Jesus doesn't know, which proves then that Jesus must not be the prophet that others think he is. Watching all this unfold, Simon can hardly contain himself. His skepticism of Jesus has given birth to full-blown rejection. He's no prophet, he says to himself. But Simon has misjudged Jesus and his authority. Simon sees Jesus as either clueless or classless, clueless for not realizing what kind of woman this is, or classless for allowing her to do what she does. He's missed that Jesus is truly the one who has authority to forgive sins. And so the scene ends with Simon and other guests asking the leading question that we've heard before. Who is this? Who is this who even forgives sins? A question that's not answered, because you and I must supply the answer. In a confrontation with Jesus' authority, the options are either faith or offense. There really isn't middle ground. You see, the authority of Jesus calls for humble faith that submits reverently. And we get to see this in the centurion at the beginning of the chapter in our last little story we'll look at this morning. Now, a Roman centurion was a middle-ranking officer. He receives orders from a commander in Caesarea, about 50 miles away, but as the word centurion would lead us to believe, he's got 100 soldiers himself that are responsible to him. Well, this particular centurion is apparently well thought of by the local Jewish leadership. So when a servant of the centurion, one that he values highly, becomes sick to the point of death, some Jewish elders lobby Jesus on his behalf. They suggest that the centurion is worthy of assistance from Jesus because this centurion had helped them build their synagogue there in Capernaum. So picking up in verse 6, so Jesus went with them. He was not far from the house. When the centurion sent friends to him to say, Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. That is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I am a man, I myself am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. Jesus responds to the initial request. He's going with them to see and heal the slave when a second delegation from the centurion arrives. The Jewish elders think the centurion is worthy of Jesus' mercy. The centurion, on the other hand, says that he does not think that he is worthy to have Jesus in his own house. Instead, the centurion appeals to Jesus' authority. He believes that Jesus has the power to heal and the right to use that power as he wishes. He rightly understands that the healing power of Jesus does not require that Jesus touch the servant or even see the servant. So great is the authority of Christ that he can simply issue the command. And so Jesus commends his humble faith. Verse 9, when Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him. And turning to the crowd following him, he said, I tell you, I have not found such great faith even in Israel. The men who had been sent returned to the house and found the servant well. You know, normally, if you've been kind of paying attention as we've been reading through the Gospel of Luke, normally it is Jesus who says and does things that astonish other people. They marvel or are amazed at Jesus. But here, perhaps only here, it's Jesus who is amazed. The centurion's faith isn't abstract. It isn't just an intellectual assent to certain truths. The centurion simply believes that when Jesus commands that something be done, it will be done. And it was. So what would it look like for you to show such humble faith in Christ that it would cause Jesus to marvel with delight. Where in your life do you need the intervention of the Lord who has the authority to heal and to forgive with a simple command? How is he calling you to reverent submission as an expression of your faith? Similarly, as with the women in their stories, where do you need the compassion of Jesus? And will you receive that mercy and respond with a lavish love? And where do you wrestle yourself with that question, who is Jesus? Will you direct your questions and doubts toward an honest faith? See, the underlying premise of all of these stories, and it's part of Luke's wonderful gospel, is that no one is beyond the reach of Jesus. Not a Gentile slave that Jesus cannot see, not a young man who is dead and Jesus cannot touch, not a sinful woman who is rejected by the religious, not even you and me.